Welcome to the ninth lesson in this verse-by-verse series through the book of Zechariah, brought to you by Mission 119 Ministries. This series is titled Looking Forward, Living Now. More detailed notes are available in book form in the commentary Looking Forward, Living Now, available on Amazon. Our text today is the eighth chapter of the book of Zechariah, and the title of this lesson is Kingdom Blessings. Now, it's part of our human experience that when we anticipate a significant future event, it changes how we plan, think, and live in anticipation of that event. When a couple is expecting a baby, they prepare a nursery, they purchase car seats and clothes and various other necessaries, all based on a future event they believe will happen. When we plan a vacation and we get it on our calendar and book the flights and hotels, we look forward to it with great anticipation. And in the interim before the vacation, we make plans about what to pack, what to do each day of the trip, and we tell other people about our vacation. In the second movie in the Back to the Future franchise, the antagonist, Biff Tannen, obtains a magazine showing the outcome of all major sporting events for the next several decades. Naturally, he gambles on all of them and becomes very wealthy and powerful because he knows ahead of time who all the winners are. As Christians, we also know who the winners are. The prophetic content of the Bible is practical, and it's not mere head knowledge, because what we believe about the future will affect what we think and what we do now. The significance of the future is proportional to how it affects us now. The remnant in Jerusalem, a city in need of repair, and the new temple still incomplete, what greater assurance could they have than hearing God promise a glorious future for the city where he would personally dwell? And for Christians today, our place in God's plan for the future is also assured. If we believe God's promised future blessings, that should change us. And if we understand the nature of Jesus' kingdom, one of our responses should be a devotion to righteousness. Now, in the prior messages that are all available in sermon audio, we've covered the first seven chapters of the book, and there's been some focus on the organization of the book. Chapters 7 and 8 form a hinge between what we call the night visions of chapters 1 through 6 and the eschatologically focused chapters 9 through 14 in the book. Chapter 7 begins with a delegation from the city of Bethel with religious questions about fasting that they want to ask the priest and the prophets, including Zechariah. Those questions are not directly answered in chapter 7, but in this chapter we will see the second half of God's response. This chapter may be best described as a complete reversal of the circumstances for the nation described in the prior chapter. These two chapters, chapter 7 and 8, together address proper heart motivations in worship, practical righteousness, and the blessings to be experienced in the future messianic kingdom. In this way, the practical principles of the first six chapters are linked to the remaining chapters that look primarily to the future work of Jesus Christ. The material in chapter 8 is organized around, as one writer calls it, a decalogue of promises, each of which begins with the word, "Thus saith Yahweh of hosts." That's from James Smith in his book, The Minor Prophets. The emphasis throughout this chapter is on the sovereign God who's able to bring these promises to pass for his people. So with this background, let's look to the text, verses 1 and 2 of chapter 8. If you're in a place to open your own Bibles and read along, I'd encourage you to do that. The prophet writes, "Again the word of the Lord of hosts came to me, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury." In this chapter, the focus is on a restored Israel. Much of what God says will be fulfilled in part by his people in Zechariah's day, but completely fulfilled in the future. But it's critical that God did not only, or even primarily, speak to their own time. God gives Zechariah a message for the people about a glorious future in order to encourage them to see themselves in God's unfolding plan. This looking forward perspective will allow them to move in faith as their thinking and their actions are reoriented around the promises of God. And by application, we need to have this looking forward perspective. Zechariah first says, "Again, the word of the Lord of hosts came to me." These words introduce the prophecy that appears in verses 1 through 17, and the same phrase introduces the prophecy in verses 18 through 23. Unlike the eight night visions of chapters 1 through 6, we do not find Zechariah looking up and observing what God has for him, or in just some other way receiving a vision or a dream. Instead, the prophet receives the word of the Lord of hosts, and just as he does in the messages in chapter 7. We're not told exactly how it is that God gives this word to Zechariah, only the fact of it. Zechariah emphasizes throughout this chapter that it is God's message. Indeed, it's the message of the sovereign Lord of hosts who saith, "I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury." Critically, both instances here in the King James, translating was, that is, as a past tense, should really be present tense, consistent with the translation in chapter 1, verse 14, where God says, "I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy." And we should note that in chapter 1, verses 14 to 17, it's very similar to these opening verses in chapter 8 and is also in the present tense. You can compare chapter 1, verse 16. God says, "I am returned to Jerusalem. My house shall be built in it." With what we see here in chapter 8, verse 3, "I am returned unto Zion and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem." And so God speaks to his people through Zechariah about what he is presently doing and will do for Zion because of his great jealousy. Zion, of course, is a mountain in Jerusalem, but it's used here to represent the whole city and its people. It is a figure of speech where a part is used for the whole, and the reference to this mountain represents Jerusalem, as is very common in other places in the Old Testament. The word jealousy is understood in our day in a negative way, as in a jealous lover or something of that sort, but it can be positive or negative depending on the context. Okay, so the point in the first promise here is that God will bless them and protect them with great fury from their enemies. God's jealousy for his people speaks of his love in action for their protection and well-being, both physically and spiritually. We see this in the New Testament when the Apostle Paul speaks of having a godly jealousy for the people he ministered to in the church in Corinth. We read in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 2, "For I am jealous over you with godly jealousy, for I have espoused you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ." Those are the words of Paul. We could certainly say that parents have, or should have, a positive jealousy for the well-being of their children, looking out for their physical and spiritual well-being. And by application, in God's love for us, he looks out for us with jealousy. He has no tolerance for rivals. Now, verse 3, the prophet writes, "Thus saith the Lord, I am returned unto Zion and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth, and the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain." With this second promise, God assures his people, "I am returned unto Zion and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem." As previously noted, reference to Zion is for the city of Jerusalem, and that's clear in the parallelism in this verse. God had returned unto Zion with blessings for his people, but there's more to come. God promises his holy presence in the midst of his people. Surely there is no greater blessing and protection than to have God himself dwelling in Jerusalem. When we read this promise about God's return to Jerusalem, we must remind ourselves that according to the prophet Ezekiel, God previously abandoned the temple and Jerusalem, and that permitted the Babylonians to destroy both back in 586, 587 BC. For example, Ezekiel chapter 10, verses 18 to 19, "Then the glory of the Lord departed from off the threshold of the house and stood over the cherubims. And the cherubims lifted up their wings and mounted up from the earth in my sight. When they went out, the wheels also were beside them, and every one stood at the door of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the Lord of Israel was over them above. Similarly, in Ezekiel 11:22, then did the cherubims lift up their wings and the wheels beside them, and the glory of the God of Israel was over above them. And the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood upon the mountain, which is on the east side of the city. So these promises raise basic questions about how and when God will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Some expositors err at this verse by spiritualizing away the force of what is written. But Zechariah says that God will be the glory in the midst of Jerusalem, as he did in chapter 2, verse 5, and will dwell in the midst of thee, as he did in chapter 2, verses 10 to 11. And so the promise of the present verse parallels the promise of chapter 8, verse 8, that, quote, I will bring them, my people, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Just as God's people, delivered from the east country and from the west country, chapter 8, verse 7, will literally dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, chapter 8, verse 8, at that future time, so also will God literally dwell in Jerusalem with his people. What becomes indisputably evident later in the book is that the moving agent for God dwelling or being physically manifested in Jerusalem will be none other than the coming Messiah, Jesus Christ. Now, we've previously noted that the parallel to chapter 1, and in particular in chapter 1, verse 16, we read, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. My house shall be built in it, saith the Lord of hosts, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. We further reference here to the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain. And this is a reference to the Temple Mount. You can compare to Haggai chapter 1, verse 8. And this reference to the Temple Mount suggests the presence of the temple in Jerusalem. But the promise here, and in the balance of the chapter, of God's literal presence in Jerusalem, the regathering of his people from the nations to the land, and the nations coming to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem and to pray before the Lord, chapter 8, verse 22, these all point forward to the conditions immediately before and in the Messianic kingdom. Thus, God has returned unto Jerusalem or unto Zion with blessing, but the words will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem look ahead for their literal fulfillment. With God's presence, the city will be radically transformed, no longer the place of sin that brought God's wrath and the consequent Babylonian captivity, but in fact a city of truth, the text tells us. The Hebrew word here, emet, carries the idea of faithfulness. Because of God's presence, Jerusalem will enjoy a reputation of faithfulness to God. It is also a place of holiness, for the holy mountain is there. It's not merely that the city is different in the future, but that its inhabitants are radically different people than their forefathers. We should recall that the visions in Zechariah 4 show the Messianic age will be characterized by righteousness. The prophet builds further on this theme in chapter 14, verses 20 and 21, observing there that the bells of the horses in every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. Holiness will characterize even the smallest detail of daily life. As commentator Dennett states, quote, wherever God condescends to dwell, whether in the tabernacle, temple, or in the church, truth and holiness must be maintained, end of quote. The promise has never been fulfilled at any time in Israel's history, but looking at those promises through the lens of the New Testament, we recognize that while there is some level of revival in Zechariah's day, this was only a foretaste of what lies ahead when Jesus Christ returns to rule and reign from Jerusalem. But at that time, at the same time, it's critical when we read about events still future, even from our standpoint today, that we understand God's words are meant to stir his people, both then, during Zechariah's day, and now as we see the words. They should stir us to action in this moment. In Zechariah's day, they're motivated to complete the temple. The glory of the coming kingdom should likewise change our perspective and stir us to action, and especially to evangelism and discipleship. Now, moving on to verses 4 and 5, thus saith the Lord of hosts, there shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, and every man with his staff in his hand for very age. and the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof. This verse presents the third promise from the Lord of hosts, and it continues the description of the conditions that will prevail when God dwells in the midst of Jerusalem. In contrast to the pervasive death, destruction, and defeat of their recent history, Israel's future will be characterized by security, joy, and longevity. This era of prosperity will see old men and old women dwelling in the streets of Jerusalem to emphasize their age. The prophet even adds the words, "Every man with his staff in his hand for very age." You know, in times of war, the most vulnerable are the first to die. And when there is a cloud of potential attack and destruction, the people do not assemble in the streets. The picture here is a reversal of circumstances so that people reach old age and they dwell securely, which means the entirety of the remnant at that future time will enjoy peace and security. At the other end of the spectrum are the very young people. Mirroring verse 4, the prophet says, "The streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof." This pictures not only security, but prosperity in a way that's not measured in dollars and cents. Families are returned to Jerusalem and they thrive, untarnished by poverty, violence, and war, as evidenced by an abundance of children. And they are happy and safe. Sadly, this is not a present reality in many parts of the world, and even in many parts of the United States. What politicians promised but failed to deliver, God will in fact accomplish when the Messianic kingdom is established. This will be the golden era that's never been experienced previously. Verse 6, the prophet says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, if it be marvelous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in these days, should it also be marvelous in mine eyes, saith the Lord of hosts." This verse presents the fourth promise from the Lord of hosts, but it does so in the form of a rhetorical question that warns against allowing human reason to decide what God is likely to do. Zechariah addresses the remnant of this people in these days. We should first note the use of the term remnant that we also see in verses 11 and 12. It's a term that refers to those that survived the exile in Babylon. God anticipates their doubts about these promised future blessings. When God says, if it be marvelous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in these days, should it also be marvelous in mine eyes? You know, what God is saying is completely rhetorical. The required answer is no. But the question speaks with assurance to those tempted to walk by sight, not by faith, or to borrow from a familiar example from the time of Exodus, Numbers 13 to 14, to those who would stop at the river of impossibilities instead of crossing the Jordan with their spiritual eyes firmly focused on the promises of God waiting on the other side. Regardless of whether these promises might seem incredible or marvelous in their eyes, they are not impossible or marvelous for God. In fact, such promised future blessings about the conditions of the kingdom are the natural result of God dwelling in their midst. The force of God's rhetorical question is to double down on his promises, assuring the remnant these things shall come to pass. We do well to remember Jesus' words from Luke 18:27. "These things which are impossible with men are possible with God." The heart of the matter is faith, for without faith it's impossible to please God, Hebrews 11:6. And critically, believing what God says about the future should change us now. Now moving to verses 7 and 8, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country, and I will bring them, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and in righteousness." This presents the fifth promise from the Lord of hosts, namely the regathering of God's dispersed people to Jerusalem. These two verses explain how God will bring about the blessings of the preceding verses. The prophet records God's promise that he will save his people from the east country and from the west country. As scholar Eugene Merrill explains, the terms for the directions here are much more cosmic in scope than the usual ones, referring respectively to the rising and the setting of the sun. This suggests that the immigrants will come not only from the immediately surrounding areas, but from the very ends of the earth. This is also the import of limiting the scope to the two directions, for the sun relates to the earth only in terms of east and west, not north and south. End of his quote. So in short, God assures this small remnant a complete restoration will come about as God brings the Jewish people scattered abroad back home. Note that the prophet indicates a future blessing with the words, "I will save, and I will bring, and they shall dwell, and they shall be." While a limited return of exiles from Babylon already occurred, this future regathering is global in scope. It will coincide with the time when God himself will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth, as we read in verse 3. At that time, God will bring them, and they shall also dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and in righteousness. This is not merely a physical gathering, but a time of spiritual revival. For the prophet says, they shall be his people in truth and righteousness. Zechariah will return to this theme of spiritual revival in chapter 12, verses 10 to 14. These promises look forward to the enlarged Jerusalem promised in Zechariah 2, when God shall call the scattered people home, as we read in chapter 2, verses 6 to 7. God will dwell in the midst of thee, chapter 2, verse 10, and he will be joined by many nations, chapter 2, verse 11. This, of course, will occur when Messiah establishes his kingdom, for only then will many nations be joined to the Lord in that day and shall be his people, chapter 2, verse 11. We read Jesus' promise of his return and regathering of his people in the Olivet Discourse, and I will read a few verses from Matthew 24, because it is important as we read this prophecies to connect it to the New Testament and to see as Jesus and the other New Testament writers would refer to it. Matthew 24, 29 to 31, immediately after the tribulation of those days, shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken, and then shall appear the Son of Man, the sign of the Son of Man, in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. This spiritual revival that's promised is key to the assurance of other blessings. Edward Dennett has said, it is of great moment to observe that all the happiness and prosperity above described will flow from their established relationship with God. They shall be his people, and he will be their God in truth, in the truth of what he is as revealed in his covenant relationship with Israel, and in righteousness, this characterizing the government under which they shall be placed. Now, moving to verse 9, the prophet writes, thus saith the Lord of hosts, let your hands be strong, ye that hear in these days these words by the mouth of the prophets, which were in the day that the foundation of the house of the Lord of hosts was laid, that the temple might be built. The short message contained in verses 9 through 13 are all about encouragement, and it contains the bookends that we'll see denoted by the language, let your hands be strong, verses 8 and verse 13. Now, the Lord of Hosts, the Lord of Hosts addresses those that hear in the days these words by the mouth of the prophets, which were in the day that the foundation of the house of the Lord of Hosts was laid. In other words, the message addresses the people in Zechariah's present day who were also alive and heard the prophets when the foundation of the temple was laid. They're being called to look back in their minds and remember when the prophets first spoke to them in the past, encouraging the rebuilding of the temple, and they, in turn, laid the foundation. The present state of progress on the temple reconstruction provides ample confirmation of the truth of the words that the prophets spoke to them years ago, saying that they would see the temple completed, so they needed to put their hands to work. The reference prophets are not named, but they may include Haggai and others. Now it is time to once again to move forward in assurance of what God promises. They must, and I quote for the text here, let their hands be strong. In other places in the Old Testament, for example, Judges 7 verse 11, 2 Samuel 16, verse 21. This expression means to take courage, to let your hands be strong, to take courage. And here it is time to take courage in God's faithfulness. All of the promised blessings earlier in the chapter will come to pass, but only in response to an obedient people. We too have many promised future blessings of God as well as assigned tasks in the interim. How easy it is to be overwhelmed by our circumstances or even overwhelmed just by good things like being at church every time the doors are opened or getting the kids to school and their extracurricular activities, taking care of our work responsibilities. To us as well, we need to not lose sight of the main thing, being God's ambassadors in a world that needs to hear about Jesus. And to us, the prophet Zechariah would say, let your hands be strong. This is not finding strength in our own resources and self-discipline, but courage in God's resources, for otherwise we could never be strong. Now verses 10 through 12. For before these days there was no hire for man, nor any hire for beast, neither was there any peace to him that went out or came in because of the affliction. For I set all men, every one against his neighbor. But now I will not be under the residue of this people as in the former days, saith the Lord of hosts. For the seed shall be prosperous, the vine shall give her fruit, and the ground shall give her increase, and the heaven shall give their dew, and I will cause the remnant of this people to possess all these things. So in this sixth promise, God takes them back to a time before these days, that is, before the temple construction was underway. Often we need to look back before we can get the right focus looking forward. And to this end, God reminded them of these days when there was no hire for man, nor any hire for beast. Neither was there any peace to him that went out or came in because of the affliction, for I set all men, every one against his neighbor. In other words, before God brought the remnant back to Jerusalem during the captivity, Judah was a desolate place. It was characterized by what we would call an economic depression. There were no jobs. This resulted in affliction and violence, and to such a degree that people would stay off the streets. This is a far cry from the future prosperity that God has promised in chapter 8, verses 4 to 5, that looks to a time of peace when the streets are filled with people old and young. God brought about those dire conditions, and in fact, God set all men, everyone against his neighbor. We should realize that as Christians, we are fools if we believe we can find political solutions to spiritual problems. Imagine how the politicians would have promised a way out of these conditions that prevailed that Zechariah speaks of. But if God created these conditions in response to the rebellion of his people, only God is able to turn despair into blessing in response to the renewed faithfulness of his people. Now, at the time of Zechariah's message, the people moved in faith in rebuilding the temple. In response, we had the promised sixth blessing of the Lord of hosts that, in contrast to the time before, God says, now I will not be under their residue or remnant of this people as in the former days. In fact, instead of economic depression and violence, now the seed shall be prosperous, the vine shall give her fruit, and the ground shall give her increase in the heavens. Shall give their due. The prophet speaks in agricultural terms about abundant rain and crops, but the message is simple. God promises prosperity to his people. Israel's economic prosperity and ours today in the United States or in whatever country you may live where you're listening to this message, it's in God's hands. This does not mean that we should not take an interest in politics and vote on people based on biblical principles to do what we can to foster prosperity. But in the end, the politicians could do nothing at all if God's hand of blessing is not upon us. God says, I will cause the remnant of this people to possess all these blessings. This message parallels Haggai's message in Haggai chapter 1, verses 10 to 11, and chapter 2, verse 19. And it brings to fulfillment the warnings and the blessings of Leviticus 26, verses 3 to 10, and Deuteronomy 28, verses 11 to 12. Let me read verse 13. It shall come to pass that as you were a curse among the heathen, O house of Judah and house of Israel, so will I save you, and you shall be a blessing. Fear not, but let your hands be strong. Although it had been centuries since Israel was a united kingdom, God now makes clear that the blessings he promises are for all of his people, not just Judah. The northern kingdom, what we would refer to as the house of Israel, was defeated and scattered by the Assyrians, and later the southern kingdom, what we call the house of Judah, was defeated and scattered by the Babylonians. In their scattering, they were a curse among the heathen, meaning the Gentile nations. But what does it mean they were a curse among them? They were looked upon by these Gentile nations where they were scattered as a curse or a byword. Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 37 specifically warned of the penalty for sustained disobedience to the Mosaic covenant. And I quote, "And thou shalt become an astonishment, a proverb, and a byword among all the nations whither the Lord shall lead thee." So what God will do now is reverse all of that. They will no longer be a cursed or judged people scattered among the Gentiles, but a blessed people in their land that God promised them. God assures his people a future restoration as a unified nation. He will save or deliver them, meaning he will restore them to the land. And instead of being a curse among the nations, they shall be a blessing to the world, which will recognize this reversal of fortune that God has brought about. In light of this promised future blessing, God ends this short message where it all started, that is with the admonition to fear not, but let your hands be strong. That is, take courage in light of my promises, God says. In the immediate context, they should continue pressing forward with the reconstruction of the temple, but they should also continue pressing forward in spiritual revitalization. Now, reading from verses 14 to 15, "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, as I thought to punish you when your fathers provoked me to wrath, saith the Lord of hosts, and I repented not, so again have I thought in these days to do well unto Jerusalem and to the house of Judah, fear ye not." In this seventh promise, the Lord of hosts promises his divine favor. God reminds them that he previously thought to punish his people by bringing in the Babylonians to take them into captivity when their fathers provoked him to wrath. And at the same time, God repented not, meaning he didn't have second thoughts or change course or relent in that judgment. But now in these days, God has thought to do well unto Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. God determines to pour out blessings on them, and once again, he will not have second thoughts. The word used here for thought is the Hebrew zamamti, and except for this verse, it's exclusively used of God's determination to bring judgment on his people. Only here is it used to show an equal determination to bring blessing. Because the fulfillment of this promise is certain, God could encourage them through the prophet Zechariah, "Fear ye not." Fear must be replaced with faith. Fear shrinks back, but faith presses forward in the earnest expectation that God will do what he said he would do, what he promises us. Verses 16 to 17. "These are the things that you shall do. Speak ye every man the truth to his neighbor. Execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gates. And let none of you imagine evil in your hearts against his neighbor. And love no false oath, for all these are things that I hate, saith the Lord." We err if we read about God's promised future blessings and do not see the practical edge of these truths for our lives today. When Habakkuk said, "The just shall live by faith," Habakkuk 2 verse 4, he meant they would live on the basis of a conviction in the veracity of God's word. The author of the book of Hebrews described faith for the Christian life as the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Those things hoped for and things not seen are the fulfillment of God's promised future blessings. A person living by faith is convinced of God's promises, and his or her life will be reoriented around the promises. Faith makes the promises tangible. It makes them substance and transformative or evidence. In these verses, the prophet calls for a response to God's promises that harkens back to the similar exhortations to righteousness in Zechariah chapter 7, verses 9 to 10, made to the generation that went into exile. This generation, the current generation, has the opportunity for a do-over, to obey and be blessed, where the earlier generation failed. Zechariah specifies the things that ye shall do. We need to put this exhortation against the earlier promises in this chapter of God's future blessings that included regathering the people, dwelling in their midst, and providing peace and prosperity. It would be absurd for a people to believe such promises and not change. And practical righteousness is the proper response to God's promises. He says that they should speak ye every man the truth to his neighbor. Remember from verse 3 in this chapter, Jerusalem is going to be called a city of truth. The faith response to this promised future blessing that Jerusalem will be a city of truth is that you would tell the truth now. Similarly, they should execute the judgment of truth and peace in their gates. As conflicts are resolved at the city gates, it should be done so on the basis of truthful testimony, for they should love no false oath. God does not mince any words here. He detests dishonesty and injustice, for all these are things that I hate, God's word says here in Zechariah. When God dwells in their midst, the city will be characterized by truth, and so God's people should live that way in the present. None of them should imagine evil in their hearts against their neighbor. The absence of peace characterized the desolation after the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem. But since God's promises, since God promises the blessings of peace and prosperity in the future, his people should purpose to live in harmony now. One final comment about these verses is in order. God says he hates dishonesty and ill treatment of our neighbors. Being the people of God entails hating what God hates and loving what God loves. This has application to all of us. Verses 18 to 19. And the word of the Lord of hosts came unto me, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, The fast of the fourth month, and the fast of the fifth month, and the fast of the seventh, and the fast of the tenth, shall be to the house of Judah joy and gladness and cheerful feast. Therefore love the truth and peace. The remaining verses in Zechariah chapter 8 prove that chapter 7 and 8 are a cohesive unit. Chapter 7 opens with a question from the envoy from Bethel about fasting. God answers there with a question about their motives when they fasted during the captivity. But here in chapter 8, God resumes his response to the fasting inquiry. The organization of these two chapters with bookends about fasting makes good sense because the intervening materials emphasize God's promised blessings for his people. Those blessings must factor into the analysis of the fasting question, since fasting is most often associated with mourning and sorrow, not blessings. This bookend of God's response not only explains that the prior fast in sorrow will be turned to fast of joy, but also that this joy will be associated with such blessings on the nation that instead of one city, namely Bethel, sending a delegation to Jerusalem, the nations of the world will send delegations to Jerusalem to rejoice. Zechariah again reminds us that what he says is in fact the word of the Lord of hosts that came unto him. The Lord of hosts specifically addresses the fast of the fourth month and the fast of the fifth and the fast of the seventh and the fast of the tenth. Now you may recall the Bethel delegation only inquires about the fast of the fifth month, chapter 7, verse 4, and God's initial response addressed the fast of the fifth and seventh months, chapter 7, verse 5. But now God addresses four separate fasts. The fast of the fourth month commemorates the day when the Babylonian army broke through the walls of Jerusalem. The fast of the tenth month commemorates the beginning of the siege on Jerusalem. The fast of the fifth month commemorates the burning of Jerusalem in 586 BC, and the fast of the seventh month commemorates the death of Gedaliah, the Jewish governor. Now, whereas during the captivity, the fasts were times of sorrow and mourning over their captivity, the destruction of their homeland and their removal from it, in the coming kingdom, the fast days will be to the house of Judah joy and gladness and cheerful feast. Three different words or phrases are used here to describe the change of circumstances. The first is the Hebrew sason, which means exultation or rejoicing. The term translated gladness is sima. It means mirth and usually refers to fellowship. The third term translated cheerful feast is moedim and only occurs here in the entire Bible. It means good or pleasant assemblies. Now, whereas Jerusalem's past brings painful memories, the future will be a cause for celebration, just as God also promised through the prophet Jeremiah in Jeremiah 31, verse 10 to 14. Now, as for the subsequent verses, we will see that the time of joy and gladness is going to occur in the coming Messianic age when the Lord dwells among his people and they are prospered in every way. But based on those promised future blessings and God's assurance that he has presently returned to Israel with blessing, in their present circumstances, there is reason for gladness at what God is doing and will do. In light of the word therefore, we see here the reversal of fortune and promised blessings. In light of what God has said about this reversal of fortune, God's appeal to them is to, quote, love the truth and peace. Here again, as in chapter 8, verses 16 to 17, God's promised future blessings should elicit a response of righteousness. This time of future peace and prosperity when God dwells with his people will be characterized by truth and holiness according to chapter 8, verse 3, and for that reason, God's people should presently fashion their lives in light of this reality. It would be absurd if God's people should live the opposite of truth and peace while allegedly looking forward with great anticipation to the kingdom that will be an unprecedented time of truth and peace. We must also take notice that God says through the prophet Zechariah that they should not merely do truth and peace, but love those qualities. This is an inward reality, not merely an externality. Now, verses 20 to 23. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, it shall yet come to pass that there shall come people and the inhabitants of many cities, and the inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, let us go speedily to pray before the Lord and to seek the Lord of hosts. I will go also. Yea, many people and strong nations shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem and to pray before the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all the languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. Now, once again, we read the familiar, thus saith the Lord of hosts. We must put what follows into context of what the prophet has already said, and especially his reference in chapter 8, verse 13, that they were formerly a curse among the heathen. This reversal of fortune outlined in this chapter includes a unified Israel's place among the nations of the world. Rather than being a curse among the heathen, the Jewish people will be a blessing to the nations. In place of the rampant anti-Semitism that we witness even today, sadly, even in the United States and too often among professing Christians, there will be an acknowledgement of God's bountiful blessings among them at this future time. And accordingly, God says to the prophet, it shall come to pass that there shall come people and inhabitants of many cities, and the inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, let us go speedily to pray before the Lord and to seek the Lord of hosts. I will go also. You know, in contrast to a single small delegation from Bethel coming to Jerusalem to seek answers from God's priests and prophets, in this future time, the inhabitants of many cities will make the pilgrimage to Jerusalem, but they do not seek the wisdom of priests and prophets because the Lord himself will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, as we read in verse 3. These people from many cities come to pray before the Lord, and not only that, they come speedily, meaning with great urgency because of their deep desire to seek the Lord of hosts. Moreover, we read, the inhabitants of one city shall go to another city to encourage others to join them on their journey, promising to go also with them. This pictures a national revival in Israel, resulting in a believing Jewish remnant that seeks the Lord who is in Jerusalem, whom Zechariah later confirms is the promised Messiah. In fact, the prophet will speak to both advents of the Messiah, his rejection at the first advent, that is his death, as well as his return. We know from God's progressive revelation in the New Testament that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, who is largely rejected by the Jewish people during his earthly ministry in the first century, but Zechariah looks beyond that to a future time when all of that is reversed. Jesus anticipated this just prior to a few days prior to his crucifixion, when he said in Matthew 23:39, for I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth till you say, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. The generation during the first advent wanted Barabbas, but a future generation will welcome Jesus as the Messiah. And that is what Zechariah sees here. God is not through with Israel because of the rebellion in the first century. As the Apostle Paul wrote in Romans, because of unbelief they were broken off, Romans 11:10. But he also wrote, if they abide not still in unbelief, they shall be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in again, Romans 11:23. That is exactly the future Zechariah sees here. Moreover, the prophet writes, many people in strong nations shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem and to pray before the Lord. So again, there's a literal emphasis. And the prophet shows us the revival is not localized to Israel, but is global in scope. All these false religions of the nations have been discarded and replaced with worship of the Lord. People from the nations of the world are not coming to worship in Jerusalem for anything less, and this is so critical, they're not coming for anything less than the reality that the Lord physically dwells there. They seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem because he is physically and visibly present there. They do not make the pilgrimage to pray to the Lord, but rather to pray before him, meaning in his very presence. Too many modern expositors, unwilling to accept God's plain spoken promise at face value, spiritualize away the force of this passage. But what more could God say that is not already here to unequivocally promise his actual presence in the holy city and his receiving believers from all the nations to worship him there? Jerusalem will be at the center of a great worldwide revival. We see that in this present passage, Isaiah 2 verses 1 to 5, Isaiah 60 verses 1 to 3, Micah 4 verses 1 to 5. This is the Tower of Babel episode from the book of Genesis, but all reversed as the nations come together in unity, peace, and prosperity in the very presence of God. The temple there is no longer just a place of worship for the Jewish people, but for all people. God spoke of this moment in Isaiah 56, verse 7, when he said, even them will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for mine house shall be called a house of prayer for all people. Now, building on this theme further, the prophet again says, thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all the languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew. The picture is 10 Gentiles taking hold of the skirt of a single Jewish person to join him because of their recognition that God is with him. The Gentiles have heard how that God is with the Jewish people, showing that their reputation is global in scope. The nation Israel finally is a light to the world as it was always intended to be. So excited are the peoples of the world to share in the blessings of the Jewish people that they shall take hold of the skirt of the Jew and proceed with him to Jerusalem. The unprecedented time in Israel's history will happen, as the prophet says, quote, in those days. This is in contrast to in the day, chapter 8, verse 9, that looked back, and in these days, 8 verse 15, that looks to the present. Zechariah's reference to those days looks forward to the literal and earthly fulfillment of all the great promises of this chapter during the Messianic kingdom when Jesus reigns on David's throne in Jerusalem. This is that day when many nations shall be joined to the Lord, chapter 2, verse 11, that we've seen before. It is also that day when every man shall be at peace with his neighbor under the vine and under the fig tree, chapter 3, verse 10. This is the last days of Isaiah 2, 2. It's the day of the Lord of Joel 2, verses 10 to 11, and so many other prophetic utterances in the Old Testament. This is the future day that hearkens us to righteousness now. Now, Zechariah 8 closes with a glimpse of Israel's future when it fulfills its designated role of being a light to the world. Gentiles, who are referenced here as men out of all languages of the nations, will implore a Jewish person to take them to Jerusalem to go before the Lord. This picture of the future seems quite impossible today, both because of the poor relations between Israel and most of the nations of the world, and because Israel is largely secularized and the Jewish people generally reject Messiah Jesus. God does not struggle with seemingly hopeless cases, And that is a good thing if God can bring about this extraordinary transformation in Israel and turn events in their relationship with the Gentile nations. What can he do in your life and mine? How easy it is to size up the circumstances, realize they're beyond our own control, and then to give up. God is not limited by your circumstances. He's not limited by mine. There's nothing beyond his control. The prophet Zechariah, all those centuries ago, he reminds us that we as Christians have a glorious future, but he also reminds us of God's power and his care for his people in this moment. May we remember as we go out about our business the rest of this week to let our hands be strong as we build for the Lord. Well, some final application points. First, the main principle. Because of God's jealousy for Israel, he will in the future bless the nation and the entire world in a time of physical and spiritual prosperity, and the Messiah will literally dwell in a revitalized Jerusalem, and the peoples of the world will go to Jerusalem to pray before him. Next application point, the Jewish remnant in Zechariah's day should let their hands be strong, that is, take courage, not on their own resources, but based on God's promised blessings to them in their time and God's promised future blessings. Next application and final application, our response to God's promised future blessings in the Messianic age, which will be characterized by peace, righteousness, and truth, should be a practical righteousness in our lives today. As I said before, it is absurd to say we look forward to being in a kingdom of righteousness and truth if we lack righteousness and truth in our lives and in our thought lives at this moment. Well, I hope you will stay with us as we continue and move into the final units of the book, beginning in chapter 9 next time. May God bless you.